then can we get resolution. The role of the world community should never be to dictate who should be what. That does not make any sense. But they should facilitate for the sides to talk together, to reach compromise, and get the right framework for agreement and power sharing. I think it will not help us if people pushed by America or Europe are brought to us. That doesn't make any sense.
Many are hopeful that the would-be Prime Minister of Somalia will be able to gain the confidence of the opposition groups in the country and bring the Horn of African nation, the beast that eluded it for nearly 2 decades. But that remains to be seen. For FSRN, I'm Abdirahman Warsame in Mogadishu.
This Saturday, thousands of people will participate in National Climate Day of Action events across the country. The Day of Action is being organized on the national level by Step It Up, a grassroots organization calling for national leadership on climate change issues. So far, 52 members of Congress and 6 presidential candidates are slated to appear at the events. Earlier today, I spoke with May Busey, a national organizer with Step It Up. She says the organization held a similar Day of Action last April. There, they rolled out the ambitious policy goal of reducing carbon output 80% by the year 2050.
With our first action, what we wanted to do is put out this important goal, which is what the NASA scientist Jim Hansen has said is where we really need to get to in our carbon reductions if we're going to face this challenge. And this is seen as a radical goal at the time. We were talking about this in January, and we said, well, this is what the science says is necessary. We've got to put this out there to people. And we got the comment from some professional organizers that that was just too crazy, and how would people really embrace a numerical goal like that? But it's really what the science has shown us we need to do, and people across the country who've been really concerned about global warming, who've seen Al Gore's movie, heard that this was an important goal, and they said, well, I want to rally around this in my community and put this out as an important national priority.
So how do you see the role of climate science in creating these localized policy goals?
Well, it's an interesting question. I think it's a complicated issue. We're talking about climate models that scientists have developed over time, and we're seeing a lot of those models, what they've predicted happening much sooner than anyone had predicted previously. So science plays a very key role in how the grassroots reacts to the issue. And, for example, in An Inconvenient Truth, that whole movie was basically Al Gore providing a scientific slideshow. Who would think that such a documentary could win an Academy Award? But it is playing an important role, and I think people see that we're playing a dangerous game with a very fragile part of our world, with the climate, and they want to hear from scientists what they need to be doing.
With Al Gore and the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change winning the Nobel Peace Prize, do you think that Peace Prize legitimized the science in the wider public?
I certainly hope so. You know, I think there's been so many examples of evidence about why this issue matters, and here's just one, yet another one of proving to people who have been skeptical that this is a major issue. And I think giving a prize to the IPCC, this massive amount of scientists all in one fell swoop, I think was a really important decision. And I think a lot of times people recognize the Nobel Prizes with individual scientists, and this is by giving it to a collective group, I think it does help legitimize the role of the scientists.
Tell me about what's happening this weekend.
Well, we're very excited about it. This November 3rd, this is our second National Day of Climate Action, and it's a call for leadership on global warming. The events across the country, which are held 1 year before the 2008 election, that's what the date marks, they're really showing the contrast between the intense concern of Americans of all stripes and the leadership vacuum in Washington, because people are going to be showing up on their all around their communities and really asking their elected officials to come and join them and address 3 key priorities that scientists have shown we need to address to deal with global warming. The first is no new coal plants. The second is an 80% reduction in carbon emissions by 2050. And the third is the creation of 5 million new green jobs. So these are the priorities that people are rallying around. And the actions are just amazing. We're getting actions in every state, hundreds of actions, and some of the coolest ones taking place. There's one in New Orleans, which is going to be a second line parade, which is the traditional New Orleans cultural event that will end at the Superdome, a very iconic location in the story of climate change. There's an event taking place in Washington, D.C. at the Lincoln Memorial, featuring speakers including Van Jones, who's really a leader on this issue of creating green jobs. And I just learned today about an event in Eugene, Oregon, at the University of Oregon, that's going to have a big march in the middle of one of the big football games at University of Oregon. So I could go on and on, but those are just three that really show the diversity that people are trying to bring to this event and all the creativity that's out there.
Well, May, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
My pleasure. Great to talk to you.
May Boosie is an organizer with Step It Up. For more information about actions happening around the country on Saturday, go to www.stepitup2007.org. Walls are being built on the U.S. border with Mexico to keep migrant workers from entering. Europe is imposing tough restrictions on undocumented migrants who brave the sea to enter. As developed nations close doors to migrant workers and immigrants, Chile is going against the tide. They're granting amnesty to undocumented immigrants who live and work in the country. From Santiago, FSRN's Jorge Garretón has more.
The wealth of a country can be measured by its economic development and living standard. Another informal measure is its capacity to attract immigrants from other parts. Chile is living that experience. The country is growing and is attracting migrant workers. Their reality forced the government to announce an immigration amnesty to some 20,000 illegal immigrants living in the country. The measure will benefit nationals from some 20 countries who live and work illegally. To solve that situation, the government is granting a three-month window beginning in mid-November for residents to legalize their situation. No questions asked, says Interior Minister Belisario Velasco.
They should have nothing to fear. If a person says, I arrived in Chile a month ago, or 2 or 3 years ago, no legal measures against them will be taken. On the contrary, their statement will be accepted on face value and that person be given legal status.
The minister added this amnesty will stop employers who abuse migrant workers.
There are many employers or individuals who hire them, abuse their immigration status, and do not pay benefits.
On the streets, the immigrant community was happy with the government decision. The largest is the Peruvian community that, according to estimates, has some 15,000 undocumented migrants. As this Peruvian woman says, she can now be with her four children.
With the national ID card, I can now travel and visit my children. Now I will have better working opportunities because employers always demand the ID card.
On the street, Chileans show support for the measure, as this man explains.
I find that it is a good decision because we have to advance to begin giving benefits to nationals from other countries. When we immigrate to other countries and demand opportunities that have been given to us, I think it is correct to give the same opportunities to people who come to our country and accept them.
That opinion, although well-founded, he's not alone. For the most part, Chileans are in agreement with the amnesty decision.
I think this is good because they need to work and we have to welcome them. They come from brother nations. I welcome that decision.
At times I like and at times I don't like the decision because they come with their customs and traditions and I feel they try to impose them on us and I don't like that.
If you ask me, I think it's good. It makes the country grow as an American nation and good vibes with all those who come.
According to political analyst Armin Kojumjian, this decision is of low political and financial cost at home and gives a positive gesture to neighboring countries that were asking for their nationals to be given legal status in Chile.
I think this move is a good combination of a decision which helps Chile's relationship with its neighbors, particularly Peru, which had been a bit tense, with a very little cost at home. In fact, there has been no negative protest or reaction of any substance in Chile. And it doesn't really cost the government much because it's a government which is not very generous with social security.
The amnesty, according to Kajumjin, citing immigrant groups, will benefit upwards of 45,000 immigrants, not the 20,000 the government claims. For FSRN, this is Jorge Garretón in Santiago.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
You're listening to KBOO.
Halloween at Holocene!
Halloween night. What are you doing? Sitting at home, eating stale candy bars, and drinking Shirley Temples heavy on the grenadine? Asking yourself where all the good times have gone?
Music bad. Band's bad.
No one has fun anymore.
No one will dance with me.
Think again, Buckaroo. It's time to get your socks knocked off at Boo-Hat!
Featuring three DJs, Rolf, Dr. Zahn, Jamila.
Hearing electronic music.
A duet between Pulse Emitter and Brisbane.
Free jazz.
Neo-pagan jazz bastards. Mod Pop. Rainbow and Kittens.
Sludgy esoteric gloom.
Mattress.
Even disco.
Even disco.
Strength and Valella Valella. At bargain basement prices.
Come to Boo Bash. October 31st at
Holocene. 8 p.m. $7 in costume.
$12.
No costume. Boo Bash. 1001 Southeast Morrison.
The time has come for Portland to have its very own Women's Festival. 2 years in the making, Siren Nation Women's Music and Films Festival will finally be born November 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 4th. Siren Nation's mission is to honor the amazing women's music, activists, and entrepreneurs here in the Pacific Northwest, as well as filmmakers from here and beyond. Siren Nation is built on celebrating women, art, and community. Thursday, November 1st, Siren Nation kicks off with a dance party at Holocene. Friday and Saturday night, live music at the Wonder Ballroom, women-directed film Saturday afternoon at the Clinton Street Theater, and on Sunday, November 4th at the McMiniman's Kennedy School, free workshops and a community marketplace. For Siren Nation ticket and schedule details, please visit www.sirennation.com. Siren Nation is under nonprofit fiscal sponsorship of In Other Words Women's Books and Resources. KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of Siren Nation, celebrating women, art, and community, November 1st through 4th.
Money. Nothing but money.
Stars in the PM, and I love the sunrise, so I step out in the AM. The street is black and shiny from the nightly rain. The glory of the light brings evaporation.
So, all right, there we go. I can hear myself in the ears. That's always nice when you're on the radio. Good evening, Portland. My name is Michael Anderson, and you are in tune to Hole in the Bucket on your community radio station, 90.7 on your FM dial. Hole in the Bucket is KBOO's show about housing, homelessness, and poverty. And tonight we have a subject a little scary, appropriate for Halloween, amping up the criminalization of the poor. This is something that we've talked about in a lot of different ways on this show. Here in Portland, the debate over the sit-lie ordinance certainly is right square up the alley on this subject. But tonight we're going to begin to focus on San Francisco, which has been one of the pilot cities nationwide for the 10-year plan to end homelessness. More than that, San Francisco has the reputation nationally of being the liberal urban bastion of the West Coast. But some recent media coverage of homelessness and poverty in the Bay Area, actually it's focused on homelessness and not poverty, has taken quite a different tune from the so-called reputation of liberal bastion. So I'm going to start by reading from an excerpt from sfgate.com, and this is an article called "Enough is Enough." San Francisco says homeless residents of the famously liberal city need to clean up their act. They're changing their views. So here's an excerpt from this. So San Francisco, the liberal left coast city conservatives love to mock, could be undergoing a transformation when it comes to homeless people. Quote, maybe there's been an epiphany, says David Latterman, president of Fall Line Analytics, a local market research firm. People have finally realized they can hate George Bush, but still not want people crapping in their doorway. End quote. The article continues. Consider the case of David Keeley, who has lived in South Market area for 18 years. He bought a home when prices were low and now lives there with his wife, Jenny, and their three boys, ages 7, 4, and 1. Kylie insists, quote, we're not some white yuppie parents that can't take this. In fact, end of quote. In fact, he says they donate to programs for homeless people. He continues to speak, quote, I don't expect to be Cow Hollow or Pacific Heights, upscale neighborhoods in San Francisco. But the other day, Jenny, his wife, is bringing the kids back from the park and some guy is standing up on the corner throwing up on himself. This article is one of a series of articles that has come out, particularly from a journalist named C.W. Nevius, but has also gotten a lot of reader response from the San Francisco Chronicle and other media outlets, with a very repetitive theme blaming folks who are homeless for being homeless and essentially being in the way of their delightful life in San Francisco. So to talk about this scary and emerging trend, we have in the studio Patrick Nolan, community organizer with Sisters of the Road. Good evening, Patrick.
Good evening. How are you doing tonight?
Very well, thank you. And we have on the line calling in from San Francisco, Paul Bowden from RAP. Paul, are you with me?
Yes, I am.
Thank you very much for joining us long distance, Paul. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, no, glad to do it.
So why don't we start with you, Paul? Tell us a little bit more about what's going on in this media discussion in San Francisco. Is there a prevalent change in the attitude of the people of San Francisco?
I don't see it. I mean, I have been working in, and I was homeless before then, and have been working in the homeless program since 1983. And granted, the first several years from, like, maybe, say, 83 to 87, actually it was more like 86, there was this real sense, I'll never forget, one of the local NPR TV affiliates, KQED, you know, doing a documentary on homelessness in the early 80s when it was first became prevalent. And all of the person in the street interviews that they did was talking about, well, something's happening with the federal government. Reagan's cutting housing. All these people are ending up homeless. And I feel that over time, progressively, as mayors have found that they're not able to or willing to challenge those federal changes, they have decided to take on homelessness because it is and has been the number one issue in local elections for many years by seeing what they can do about it. And what they can do about it is use the police and the jails, where there's unlimited funding from the federal government, to try to make it disappear. And it's always been from Dianne Feinstein, who's now a senator, she did sweeps. Art Agnos, who followed her, did sweeps. Frank Jordan, who followed Art Agnos, did a three-year campaign called Matrix that was a very aggressive anti-homeless people's policing campaign and was also very popular in the mainstream media. So, and then you had Willie Brown, and you had his sweeps and the helicopters in Golden Gate Park for heat-seeking devices that he borrowed from the Oakland City Council or city government. And now you have Gavin Newsom. And to us at the frontline level, the only thing that's different about this current campaign is the scariest part of it, which is how much it's resonating with other communities across the country.
So in other words, that the very premise that that this journalist has been putting forward.
Well, hold it though, Michael. Stop calling him a journalist or a reporter. He's a columnist.
Okay.
And he has no documentation. He uses no documentation, and he uses no facts to back up anything he says. And really, that's the scariest part of it, because when we've tried to talk to the San Francisco Chronicle editorial board. The rap is, the guy's a columnist, man. He can say whatever he wants. And the articles, it's been a whole series of 2 months of almost every other day, top of the fold, front page, attacks on needle exchange programs, on recycling programs, on homeless people themselves, on drug addicts, and on the impact on local communities that homeless people have imposed upon all the others.
So, but to go back to my point, and I think yours is excellent, is that he is a columnist, so let's refer to him as such, if that's the pigeonhole they want to protect him in. So this columnist, though, his basic assertion that there is this change in attitude, what I hear you say is, actually, it's the same old, same old. People who are homeless have always been subject to being railroaded around.
Well, I mean, I don't think it's as black and white as that. I think that they get a couple of thousand emails each time they run one of these articles on their website that they encourage. They actually encourage people to send photos as well. And, you know, this is a city of 800,000 people. So the fact that there's several thousand racist, classist, you know, anti-anything, you could pick any subject matter. And I guarantee you, you would get a visceral response from a very aggressive populace that hates those people. The promoting of that hate, the making that into this is what San Francisco thinks because this is what the people that have emailed into the Chronicle to say how much they hate these other human beings think. And therefore, that becomes what our community feels. That's the part that is disingenuous, the most disingenuous, because the San Francisco Coalition is 20 years old and doesn't get government money, is not a sexy organization for the foundations to fund, and relies overwhelmingly on the people that live in our community supporting us with $20, $25, $50 checks. You know, the Street Sheet, our newspaper, like you guys have Street Roots up there, we sell 36,000 copies a month, every month since 1989. People, you don't get that kind of sustained support from a community if everybody in that community is a racist reactionary. One of the recent emails to the Chronicle was, what we should start using is police baton approaches to addressing homelessness, and we should start with the woman that runs the Homeless Coalition in San Francisco. So here you have somebody advocating and mentioning this woman by name, Jennifer, mentioning her by name to actually have the police beat her up with their batons to get these people out of our town. If the Chronicle's going to try to pretend that represents the overall populace of the people that live in San Francisco, they need to go back to wherever Hearst lives, because that's the guy that runs the paper.
Yeah, that's a disgusting story. So, Patrick, up here in Portland, we've seen some similar stuff to what Paul's describing in terms of in both the two papers in town. We've seen that similar, I would almost describe it as a seeming cherry picking of what kind of letters they run to the editor, often again with very visceral, negative, if not directly. I don't know if we have had something that was that directly violent, but certainly the quasi sort of like, we need to get these folks out, you know, heck or high water. Are you seeing the same kind of trend here?
I would say that that a couple of the papers definitely seem more interested in showing that particular side. There are papers, a couple of the weekly papers, one in particular I could think of, really does try to look at, you know, what's happening, you know, and how's this something bigger than you know, just the fact that somebody's homeless. You know, is this something other than just that, you know, some guy is homeless and therefore if we paint over it, it's gone. You know, and but yeah, it does happen where stuff, you know, you look at it and you're like, how can you really, you know, did you look at that? Did you notice all the other things that really make this not true? You know.
Well, and I think we've also seen in some of the blogosphere around town, Paul, something that you said that really resonated with me is that it only takes a small handful of very active emailers to make it look like there's a landslide of public opinion in one way or another. Certainly, it's the same in the blogosphere. I've noticed when there's an article that goes up that's remotely about a progressive or humane policy around dealing with poverty, usually I'm looking at the housing articles, but then there's almost an immediate response where the first five or six emails that come in are as rote right-wing stuff as you're going to find anywhere on the AM dial. So I think back to your point, Paul, that rather than this larger trend or change of opinion, that this is sort of a new wave of possible disinformation, intentional or not, that comes out of the current media proclivity for showing the man on the street by isolating like one opinion as representing a lot more.
And I also think that, you know, like here there was two alternative weeklies, one the San Francisco Bay Guardian, the other the San Francisco Weekly, you know, that ran very strong articles in opposition to the sloppy journalism and the mean-spiritedness of what the San Francisco Chronicle was doing. But the San Francisco Chronicle is the white elephant. I mean, it is the monster. And when people look at, well, what's going on in San Francisco, that's the place that they go to thinking that they're getting information. And this whole consolidation of all of our media outlets, and especially our news outlets, that was done started under the previous Bush administration, signed off on by Clinton, and certainly promoted under this administration, really, they are the ones that promote the stuff that's coming out on the blogs. They are the ones that say, well, because I found a couple of people in San Francisco that hate homeless people, and you know, I can then say that means all of San Francisco, which is ultra-liberal, which it isn't. I mean, if people look at the history of San Francisco in terms of how it treated Asian Americans, how it's treated the African Americans in the Western Addition, and how it's dealing with gentrification in the downtown areas right now, you know, San Francisco's liberal towards poor people that are poor in countries in South America and Central America and other places around the world. San Francisco addresses poverty on its doorstep and panhandlers on its street the same way every other city seems to be addressing it right now.
So, and that leads to another point that I wanted to get to, and I'm going to read another quote from this column. And this is a quote that, again, I can't say to how accurate it was quoted, but it's quoting a gentleman named Trent Rohrer, who's the executive director of San Francisco's Human Service Agency. And he says, quote, "I don't think this is a liberal or conservative thing. This is quality of life for everyone. What research has shown and what we've seen from visits to cities like Philadelphia, Chicago, Portland, and New York is you need to combine good social outreach with law enforcement." Paul or Patrick, do you want to react to that statement?
You can go ahead, Paul.
It is pretty standard rhetoric for how the treatment of mentally ill people that are without housing, how homeless people, how young black men that are in neighborhoods where it's gang identified and they want to 86 people or kick them out of certain neighborhoods, and day laborers and immigrants. I mean, it's really feeding a line that the Western Regional Advocacy Project, working with Sisters and working with L.A., Seattle, Oakland, Berkeley, and have started developing a campaign to start addressing, which is, as we've seen local downtown quarters, and look at Old Town in Portland, you know, there's a premise that in order to improve the quality of life in any community so that we can attract a higher income populace to move into that community and attract better restaurants and attract art galleries, the underlying mandate is you have to remove the poor people, because it's the poor people that bring down the quality of life. And the easiest ones to remove first are the poor people that are in SROs, the single room occupancy hotels, where you can convert those hotels. So by converting the hotels into permanent housing, you can evict everybody that's in them, and to remove the people that are in the street. That's Skid Row, that's Oakland, that's Berkeley, that's Old Town, that's San Francisco, that's Seattle. It's happening, and that's just the ones we work very closely with. It's happening across the country. Certainly the South Loop in Chicago, you know, Manhattan, which became the model that so many people looked at. You know, and in order to accomplish that goal, the old days in the 60s when they used bulldozers in the redevelopment agency, they caught a lot of flack for that, and they lost a lot of lawsuits for that. And what they're using now is what they call nuisance crime enforcement. So sitting, laying, being in the park, closing the parks at night. So then if you're in the park at night, you know, we never closed our public parks until very short time ago. Our public parks used to be public space that anybody could be in.
At any time.
It's now illegal to be in those parks because the city closed those parks at certain hours.
And Patrick, talk about Portland for a second here.
Well, I've always kind of the one that always gets me is when they start talking about quality of life issues. Honestly, when I look at that, I you know, being a normal person, I think, well, how is this affecting my quality of life? And being somebody that I was homeless for 8 years in Portland, and it really kind of amazes me whenever they say, oh, this is a quality of life issue. Well, I have a quality of life issue as well, and my quality of life issue is I don't have housing.
Yeah.
And, you know, to me, it's like, okay, if you don't like the fact that if it's a quality of life issue for you that I'm sleeping on the sidewalk and I don't want to be sleeping on the sidewalk, then we should be able to work together somehow here and make sure that I've got a quality of life that, you know, we can both agree with.
And that's a perfect segue. So I'm going to send it over to my producer here, put on a little music. And I think this next song gets right to the point. Then we're going to come back, Paul and Patrick, and we're going to talk about what RAP's doing right now on this subject to address this erosion of civil rights.
Yeah.
All right. We are back on the air. Paul, you still with us?
Yep.
All right. So, yeah, so that I think that song really hits part of the problem on the head is that with one of the dynamics that strikes me from the very beginning about the anytime you talk about criminalizing poverty is, you know, it's sort of like if you have a cold and your nose is running, punching yourself in the nose to heal your cold. You know, I mean, what are you going to do? You're going to cause a bloody nose. And I think that's a lot of what we're seeing with this rhetoric and what's being stirred up is shifting the blame from the larger system, which has created increasing poverty, housing instability, and homelessness, to the people who are impacted.
Yeah, and I think, you know, for me, it's the frustration that's being exhibited. When you actually go back, which we've been doing, because next year, March 2008, is the 75-year anniversary of the signing of the New Deal legislation by Roosevelt as a way of addressing the Depression. And a lot of what we're seeing right now, maybe not at the same scale and certainly not as white as it was during the Depression, in terms of sheer numbers, it's higher, but in terms of percentage of the overall population, it may not. I'm not going to pretend it's at the same scale. But there was a concerted effort to keep poor people out of local communities. And Hoovervilles, as bad as some of them were, and some of them weren't all that bad, were sort of safe zones that the federal government created for poor people that were being criminalized, chased out of, beaten, and if they were dark-skinned, hung in local communities. And that you gotta curtail that instinct. You gotta let people know that we're a society that mandates we treat each other as human beings. And regardless of somebody's economic or housing status, and that's gone. Like, we're losing that rapidly. And when major newspapers in the United States, and San Francisco Chronicle is not alone, are putting out op-eds and columnist articles and reports from local government officials about how we need to use the police in order to address the fact that people are poor and living in our streets, and ignoring the massive cuts to affordable housing that took place from 1979 to 1983, which created this new cycle of homelessness. We need to stand together and rise up and say, you know, this is not how we're going to do it. This is not how we choose to be governed. And we can address people's poverty. We can address economic inequality. The report that just came out recently, you know, tells you that the economic benefits of our system right now in America, the way that our tax structure is set up, the way that our government is doing NAFTA and doing economic incentive for businesses, where it's called economic incentive, and calling programs that benefit low-income communities charity, we got to switch it. We got to flip the channel. So, and we can't wait for the mainstream media to do it for us. We got to do it on our own.
So, Patrick, talk a little bit about, I know that you and Paul are part of the RAP Coalition, which represents cities up and down the West Coast. Talk about RAP's response to this criminalization effort and the removal of civil rights.
Well, first of all, our work, it's the first time that I'm aware, and definitely the first involvement I've had with recognizing that the same problems exist throughout the country. It's not just a problem here in Portland. It's not just a problem in San Francisco. You know, the fact that people sleep out on the streets of Seattle is not something that is just, you know, a problem of Seattle's. And it's there have been other instances, but this is like the first one that actually is going to, to me at least, feels like it's taking a systemic approach to it. They put out a great report called Without Housing. And
they being RAP.
RAP, the Western Regional Advocacy Project.
Yeah, he meant to say us.
Yes, exactly.
I'm sorry. It's called Without Housing, and you can download it off their website, www.raphome.org. And see, Paul, I know that.
Yeah, got it.
And it really goes into really great detail about, you know, why we have this problem we have. You know, in 1979, we had like something like $83 billion in HUD budget. You know,
in adjusted dollars, yeah.
Dollars. And by 1983, that it dropped to $18 billion. You know, and people wonder, well, why are people homeless? Well, when you cut out all the money for low-income housing and you replace it with like a tiny little stream. I mean, somebody mentioned this to me the other day, and I hope it's okay to say on the air. It's like pissing on the towering inferno. You know, it's not going to solve the problem. And you've got to start looking at you know, big replacement of that money, you know, to solve this problem.
And certainly, Paul, you have been talking with folks all around the country, folks in D.C. on this very issue, pointing out the the larger dynamic at hand. What, if any, traction have you got with our elected leaders in D.C. To step up to the plate and start taking responsibility for this dynamic we find ourselves in?
Very little. I mean, if I was writing a grant, I might be a little more pronounced than that. But the reality is what the Western Regional Advocacy Project is sort of the culmination of a lot. I mean, look how long Sisters of the Road has been in Portland. The other members of RAP have been in their communities not quite as long, but almost as long, and in the case of Berkeley, Oakland, longer, is we need to create the groundswell and the mandate at the local level. You know, we have 12 national homeless organizations in Washington, D.C., and a lot of them are really righteous. Several of them are Fannie Mae funded and conservative think tank funded, meaning unlimited funding, pushing an agenda to address homelessness with 10-year plans to end chronic homelessness. And with families now being required or will be required in New York City, they jumped the gun and started implementing it already, where you got to document where you were living and you have to move a certain number of times over 6 months before you actually now qualify as being homeless. So instead of saying we got all these families that are homeless that are coming to us, so we better increase the housing budget so that we can address the needs of these families that don't have housing, they're saying, well, in order to not have to increase the funding for housing, we need to redefine what makes a family homeless. The line we're using is what Reagan did for unemployed people, which was very dramatically redefine what makes you unemployed. You now have to be in an unemployment department sanctified training program or actively receiving unemployment benefits, or you're not unemployed. You're just not working.
It's sort of define away the problem.
It's you know, and what's amazing with Martha Burt and this guy Culhane, Dennis Culhane, they use the same researchers. And HUD pays HUD Housing and Urban Development, Alfonso Jackson, with his compassion towards the people in New Orleans when they destroyed 4,000 of non-storm damaged housing units, and said, well, some people just don't deserve to live in subsidized housing. These guys pay researchers to validate their arguments. And then you have these organizations that go up against this fully funded machine with no local organizing behind them. And so what RAP is doing is connecting with those local organizations that believe in social justice, that have a spirit behind the work they're doing, that understand anybody working in poverty had damn well be not setting up 401k retirement plans, but trying to work themselves out of a job, and stop this charity mentality towards addressing inequality, poverty, homelessness, and access to treatment. You know, our three largest residential mental health facilities in the United States right now are all prisons: L.A. County Jail, Cook County Jail, and Rikers Island.
So one of the things, and I'm going to repeat the website a couple times for our listeners out there, that if you want to find more about this Without Housing report and more about the organization RAP that that both Patrick and Paul represent, the website is www.raphome.org. RAP home, one word. Paul, we've obviously had you on the show here before talking in depth about Without Housing and sort of the backdrop to how this has all happened. But I understand that one of the things that RAP has been working on is putting out another report or position paper, as it were, specifically on this issue of attacking people who are poor by taking away their civil rights. Do you want to talk to me a little bit more about that?
Sure, if you're not sick of hearing my voice. Without Housing is an awesome report, and it gave language to a lot of groups, and we know that because of the incredible response we got with the 11,000 downloads and the orders that have gone out. And the artwork worked. I mean, taking the data and the information that we were presenting and these local artists that just gave life to it by creating posters and artwork that presented it. The Library of Congress has recently just received a set that they requested of this artwork. We know that, and if you look at the Depression-era organizing that led to the New Deal, artwork and, you know, Dorothea Lange is what everybody remembers with her photographs, but there was tons of artwork that went along with that. That gives life to data and information and suffering and pride. Also, artwork also represents the pride of people that are struggling against this stuff and succeeding. But what we didn't have with it was we didn't have an organizing campaign behind it. There's already 12 housing groups out there, whatever number. But, you know, there's affordable housing groups that are already out there. On the civil rights front, human rights front, there really isn't. Not at an active organizing campaign. And some might argue that that's true with housing, but from our experience, it seemed that there was no need for us to create an affordable housing organizing campaign. It was plugging people into groups like where you work, Michael, and where other people work to strengthen the housing groups that are already out there. But on fighting on a national level, organizing and empowering communities on a national level to address homelessness at the federal level, there really isn't anything doing that right now. And so with this report, we're going to use the art. You know, the artist has expanded. The number of artists has expanded. You know, the organizations, Miami, I'm going to be in next month, talking to a legal services group there. The organizations that are like, wow, you mean there's something I can plug into? There's something I can be a part of that's bigger than just my little local community and actually try to create change? That's what's going to be in Without Rights. And Without Rights isn't going to just be about homeless people. It's going to be about people suffering from mental illness. It's going to be about immigrant rights issues and day laborer issues. It's going to be about the gang injunction task forces that are all over the freaking country right now. It's going to incorporate all of us, the educational rights of children. It's going to bring these groups together to say, we've learned enough over the last 25 years from the experience that homeless people are suffering to know that we're all headed down that road. They're going to criminalize us until we stop them.
And I think you're exactly right. I was thinking when some of your initial comments when you were talking about the different groups that have been targeted by police around the country, and it's, you know, it's people of color that don't have the legal backup of citizenship. It's young men of color who can be pigeonholed into gangs and immediately ostracized from any kind of compassionate public response. Again, it's the people who are homeless, the people who are the drug addicted, the mentally ill, all groups who, when dealt with in isolation, are very easily bowled over by the police.
Well, and, you know, we looked at, like, why are these right-wing think tanks so popular with local governments, and the broken window theory and the other books that have been produced that led to Project Connect or led to these 10-year plans. And the one key that we found, the common thread that we found in Chicago, New York, Nashville, Miami, Long Beach, San Diego, name a town, they got a program, and unfortunately I could name three-quarters of them, is they use petty little infractions where you get a ticket. Originally, you start out with a ticket where the person receiving the ticket has no legal due process rights to representation should they choose to fight it. And so the poor person that gets the ticket from the cop, that if they want to fight that ticket, their only recourse is to go in by themselves or pay for an attorney to represent them to fight that ticket. So obviously, overwhelmingly, people don't. And they don't have any money, so overwhelmingly, people don't pay the ticket. What happens at that point is a bench warrant is issued for their arrest. The bench warrant that's issued for their arrest is for failure to appear. That's the language the courts use. And it's a standard language across the board. It means you didn't show up and pay it. You didn't show up and protest it. You failed to appear. That, my friend, is 60 days and a misdemeanor offense. And so when you finally get, because then the next time the cop gives you a ticket, they call your name in. And all they know is you have a bench warrant out for your arrest. That bench warrant could be based on you sitting on a freaking sidewalk. But that's not what you're being arrested for. What you're being arrested for is because you didn't show up in court by yourself with no legal representation to fight it, and you didn't show up and pay it. And then you are now convicted of a misdemeanor. You're doing jail time until you get in front of a judge, and as the judge chooses to so decide, you're going to do 30 days, and more people are doing 30 days. And as you get a bunch of them tickets, you're in big trouble because you're a repeat offender. And it's a way of criminalizing people and avoiding the fact that everybody thinks we have public defenders that represent us if we're poor and can't afford an attorney. Well, you know, they found a loophole. They found a crack in the system where they can criminalize people enough to get them out of neighborhoods that they don't want those people in and move them somewhere else, either to jail or to some other neighborhood. And we got to fight it. We got to fight it with legal representation on the front for free, and using legal services organizations and cool attorneys that will go in and represent people for free up front. And we have to combine it with a community organizing campaign, just like there's an organizing campaign that's spreading this program out throughout the country, or we're going to find that poor people have been displaced from areas and communities where government and businesses have decided, we don't want you, get the hell out of here.
So, Patrick, we're seeing a lot of this everything that Paul's describing here with the drug-free zones, et cetera, around Portland. Has there been some movement here among Sisters of the Road to begin to reach out to some of the day labor community, some of the other groups that we're talking about, or is that something that we're going to see coming up?
Specifically with the day labor community, that's something that – We are actually looking at this time, but it is something where we as sisters feel that we need a ground level campaign, you know, amongst not just the people that are actually living with this crisis, but amongst all people that you recognize that, you know, if it's illegal for me to sit on the sidewalk one day, tomorrow it's going to be illegal for you to be sitting on the sidewalk, and
mm-hmm.
and next week it's going to be illegal to, you know, to drink water out of a fountain in certain parts of town, you know, and it's something that we all need to realize that it's not just that guy that's is having his civil rights stepped on. It's everybody.
So if there's listeners out in the audience that wanted to get involved with this in Portland, how would they contact you and how would they start plugging in?
Well, you could do one of two things. You could call me at my work phone, 503-222-5694, extension 13. Lucky number 13 for me. And my email is patrick@sistersoftheroad.org.
So again, if you get your pen and paper, listening audience, 503-222-5694, extension 13, or you can email patrick@sistersoftheroad.org.
Yes.
You can also get on the Sisters website and find Patrick's email, the phone number there. Everything's there as well if you don't have a pen and paper with you.
And if you look in our community organizing or our systemic change webpage, you'll find a link where you can join our action item list where we'll be talking a lot about this kind of stuff.
And then
or if you're driving, maybe just, check it out later.
Yeah, check it out. Exactly. Don't let go of that wheel, yeah. People.
Swing on by between 10 and 2:45. So have a meal.
This is Hole in the Bucket. You're at KBOO FM 90.7. Paul, you had sent me something up. There's going to be a forum in the next 2 or 3 weeks down in San Francisco that's directly responding to the attacks from this columnist, Mayor Newsom, and others. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, I mean, this is the best part. I mean, this is the part of all of it that, and by virtue of the fact that I get to work for Patrick and them now, I get out of the tenderloin of San Francisco and I get to go around. And there's an energy out there right now that people are like, we need to be doing something different. This getting emails and sending an email to our elected representatives and all that stuff, that's not going to work. And there's these convenings. I just came back from one in L.A. I tried to get them on the call tonight, and I wasn't able to hook up with people because in Skid Row in L.A., they're dealing with some serious stuff. And there was like nine different organizations co-hosted a human rights convening session in Skid Row in L.A. to bring all those groups together and say, we're all doing really righteous stuff. There was young attorneys, and there was law school students, and there was, legal services attorneys that technically aren't supposed to do this because they're federally funded, but they can support other people doing it. And there was community organizers, and there was service providers, and there was community members that are like, this isn't how I want to live. You know, we want to change this. And it was an incredible 3.5-hour burning hot session that people stayed through and stuck with because it's that important. And the great thing about rap is we're all learning from each other. And Seattle had put out a call to have the same kind of forum and to bring in the service providers, the housing developers, the community organizers, the day labor people, the domestic violence programs, because with these new changes in terms of homeless funding, domestic violence sufferers are going to really, really suffer because they won't be homeless. They won't have moved three times in the past 6 months. And to really say, an injury to one is an injury to all. I know that sounds trite, but, we keep doing this identity organizing thing around, well, we're the homeless people, we're the this people, we're the that people, and the reality is we're all one community, and we have to start organizing and looking at our organizing campaigns as housing, healthcare, education, living wages. Those are all one issue, and it's coming from the homeless community because the homeless community is an overview of poverty that is phenomenal. We deal with education issues for kids that don't have a home that can't get into public school. You know, there's 900,000 children in our public school systems right now, and we know that there's a whole bunch that still can't get in, and the fact that there's 900,000 should shame us all. You know, the fact that we're putting mentally ill people into jail instead of treatment, it impacts us. It impacts all of us.
Hey, Paul, could you repeat that? There's 900,000 children that are homeless that are in our schools.
Documented
right now.
By the Department of Education of the United States federal government, there are 904,000 students right now in kindergarten through 12th grade.
That's horrific.
In our public school system right now, today.
Yeah, and we 15,000 right here in Oregon. And we had two kids on a couple of weeks ago, if listeners out there, you were tuning in, talking about what it was like bouncing from school to school, you know, getting harassed by their co-students, etc. All the stuff that happens when you are put into that stigmatized corner of homeless, poor, etc.
And where I think, like, our organizing and not our in the big picture, you know, is instead of what RAP is going to be doing over the next couple of years is, you know, I'm hoping these guys never send me back to Washington, D.C. I don't care if I go back there again or not, because we need to create organizing in our local communities where Washington, D.C. is listening to us, not the other way around. Because going to those freaking hearings and going into that corridor, you know why they call it lobbying? Because you actually do talk to them in the lobby. And I'm sorry, but when somebody's talking to you in the hallway out in front of their office for 10 minutes, and you come back and say, oh, I met with so-and-so, you didn't meet with nobody.
Yeah.
You wasted an airfare.
Well, and deeper still, I think what you're talking about is this very well orchestrated matrix of researchers and studies, and where the funding comes from is cohesive enough a package that the idea that you could just lobby or convince somebody away from this is really missing what the deal is right now, and that we're at a point, whether we like it or not, but we better wake up to it, that that unless we all get together in a very aggressive way, and now, that we're going to continue to get railroaded.
Right.
And right now, it might not be you, listener out there, who is particularly on the firing line. But
and
your turn will come.
Like, we can do it with block parties. We can do it with going to the park and having burgers or having whatever, tofu burgers. I don't care. But like, we can do it with theater. We can do it with artwork.
I think that tofu burger idea is a little bit too radical, Paul. I'm going to have to shut you down on that one.
Well, I'm from San Francisco. We're all liberals down
there. That's right. So getting back to the serious part of the conversation, one of the things that came across my desk right as I was heading over to the show, but couldn't be more apropos to what we're talking about, is the Oregon Center for Public Policy just released it's really just a series of charts, but the conclusion of which is frightening, and I think really shed some light on where we find ourselves in this particular dynamic and the larger dynamic of poverty, which is when you look at from 1979 for 2005, the same span that we've been talking about where all the federal funding has been cut, at that same time, if you break all of Oregon society into fifths, okay, the bottom three-fifths, so most of Oregonians, their household income has shrunk by at least 4% over this period, their relative income. The fourth fifth has risen by just 1%, which, you know, that stands alone. The top fifth by 47%. And when you look closer at that top fifth, it's a minuscule 2 or 3% that is walking away with all the resources of our society. And then, frankly, they're the same folks funding these studies. They're the same folks who get elected to public office and then turn around and say the way to clean it up is we need to get the jackaboots, the official go-ahead, to start pounding some heads and cleaning the street. So go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sitting here nodding when you're talking. In the city of Portland right now, it takes 2.2 minimum wage jobs to rent an apartment for someone. No, that's so. You're requiring two people to work, you know, to work hard and work, you know, extra in order to pay for a place to live. You know, that's horrible. You know, what are we saying? You know, as important as low-income housing is, you know, you have to provide low-income housing, 0 to 30% of median income, you know, for people to be able to afford reasonable housing. You have to be able to provide living wage jobs for these people. You know, in the city of Portland, the median income is so high that it's impossible for somebody who's living off of our very, very nice compared to the rest of the country minimum wage. They can't do it.
Right. So in other words, just because it's not so much that the median income is so high, but the cost of living and the median home prices, I think, that you're simply outpaced by economics.
Yeah.
To just trying to keep up.
And then the third thing, we're still dealing with no health care for people. Mm-hmm. You know, and when you're in a situation where you have to make the choice, am I going to eat? Am I going to have a place to sleep? Or am I going to be able to afford my medication this month?
That's impossible. Yeah. And, you know, I think back to that columnist, and I'm going to editorialize a little bit, that idiot columnist that we started the show with, you know, his quote about the person being so upset about seeing someone throw up on themselves. Well, wait a second. Why was that person having to throw up out in the street? You know, maybe they were real sick and they had no other place to go. You know, is it gross or is it a tragedy?
It's sad.
Yeah, yeah. So, well, so unfortunately, like always on the show, that our time runs up before we get to talk about everything that we could. But, Paul, it's always a pleasure to have you on the show. I really, really, really greatly admire and appreciate the work you're doing. Patrick, we're very excited to see, I think this forum that's going on in San Francisco, I'd love to see an event like this in Portland, really giving a forum and bringing people together. So, both of you guys, thank you so much for coming on the show. Have a, happy Halloween and, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate it very much.
All right. Take care. And listeners out there, this is KBOO FM 90.7 on your dial. And thank you for tuning into Community Radio. Coming up, we have Jamila and her show, which we know is going to kick off with Stevie Wonder. So you got to stay tuned. We're going to go out with Neil Young. Keep on rocking, people.
KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon, 91.9 Columbia Gorge, 100.7 Willamette Valley, providing programming to diverse communities and unserved or underserved groups. Prison Pipeline Tuesdays at 6:30 p.m., hosted by Anne Rose Pierce, bridging the gap between prisons, prisoners, and the community. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Listen for the next edition of the KBOO Community Calendar on Thursday. This is KBOO, listener-sponsored community radio in Portland, Hood River, and Corvallis.